Paid for by IMIC Incorporated.
The Cure with Amy Cabo is brought to you by IMIC Research. Life can bring many difficult situations, domestic violence, addictions, poverty, and even sexual abuse by your loved ones. Welcome, Amy Cabo and The Cure.
Morning, and thanks for joining us today. I'm Amy Cabo, and this is The Cure. We're live every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. This show can be found in GodIsTheCure.com through podcasts. Our shows cover topics like how to heal after trauma, abuse, mental illness, common misconceptions, treatment options, healing options, promoting positive behaviors. So basically, if you're suffering from anything or if you've suffered, we're going to try to find ways to help you. As for me, I'm a survivor and I can offer my testimony. But I also invite professionals in the field, such as psychologists or experts or survivors that have become speakers and incredible stories, testimonials that are sure to inspire. And today we're going to talk about child abuse, which should not be an unpleasant topic to talk about. It's a necessary topic to discuss. Because the statistics say that 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 8 boys will experience some sort of child abuse before the age of 18. So today we have a special guest. Her name is Miranda Pachiana. Miranda Pachiana is a master. She has a master's of social work. She's a writer, a speaker, and a survivor whose work has been featured in the Huffington Post, The Mighty, Psych Central, Trigger Points, Anthology, Moms Rising, and others. She writes about a variety of subjects, including recovery from abuse and family estrangement, parenting, and grief. Miranda has spent over 2 decades addressing and examining family responses to the disclosure of child abuse. She is the creator of the online resource, The Second Wound, Coping with Family While Healing from Abuse and Assault. So, I'm also here joined by Dr. Boris Nikolov.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And I believe Miranda's with us right now. Oh, hello, Miranda. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, well, thank you. And I found that what you do extremely interesting because, I mean, abuse is very prevalent, let's just say, but the problem is that it grows, it's fostered in silence when people don't talk about it. But what are the major problems about talking about it? Is the stigma, is that you won't be believed, is that you're ashamed of it, that you think it's something bad, it's the lack of education. But you touched something very interesting, which is family estrangement, because that's my own personal experience. My mother chose not to believe me. And even in today's world, my oldest daughter now doesn't believe me. And once you have a dysfunctional family, what can you do? But maybe you can tell us a little bit about this since you're the creator of The Second Wound. Thank God.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, it's a topic that is dear to my heart because I have lived through it as well. And let me say, I'm so sorry to hear that you've had these experiences. It really is a re-victimization after having already been through the trauma of abuse and the painful work of acknowledging it and trying to heal from it. And while we can control, to some extent, the work that we choose to do as survivors to heal from our trauma, we can get therapy and attend support groups and read and get a lot of support after the fact. The pain of having family not believe or not support us, not only that, but also re-victimize us, and I can talk more about that, but hurt us in various ways, is something that often, I would say usually, doesn't end. So some people you know, I speak with a lot of survivors, and often they tell me it's worse because it doesn't have any end point.
I understand about not having an end point. I think the last time that I saw my mother, I was 18, when I gave birth to my daughter, Danielle, that was almost killed and has a severe brain injury, highly influenceable. Wow. So her father, who speaks to my mother, got her to not believe me. And so it can follow you for the rest of your life. Even if you don't speak to the dysfunctional family anymore, there could be somehow a connection, and it can come back to hurt you, even.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a pain that you can work on it, you can work through it, you can work to understand it, and it can have less of a sting over time. But it never really goes away, you know. And here Mother's Day is coming up in a couple of days, and I'm sure you and I and you have double reason for it to be, you know, less than a celebration. These are painful moments for us, and I don't have a lot of contact with my mom. I do have some, but it's always complicated, and it's usually more peaceful when, you know, we're not in touch. But would you like me to talk a little bit more about the common family dynamics that happen with the second wound, or I can tell my story and then describe more of that?
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Sure. So my experience is that I came from a large family, and I, as a child, between about the ages of 7 and 9, you know, my memory isn't perfect, but I never actually forgot my abuse. I always was aware of it and remembered it, just didn't know what it was and didn't know how to categorize it. But I was sexually abused by my older brother, and it did end at some point, you know, around 9 or 10. I'm not exactly sure why. I think that I actually was able to stand up to him, or we might have even been discovered. I don't know exactly, but it was not, you know, ever addressed or talked about. It's just something that I was very, very ashamed of, and felt that I was very different from everybody else I knew, because I had experienced these things. I knew things that I felt I shouldn't know. I felt like I lost my innocence. And I carried that, you know, throughout my whole adolescence, and it really affected me. So it was really, it's sort of a common story, is that it wasn't until I left home and I had built a life away and it was safe that I was able to start addressing this. So I was in my mid-20s. I was married, happily married, to a really supportive man, and lived an hour away from my family. I had been in therapy for a couple of years, really trusted my therapist, and I finally decided, you know what, this is something I need to talk about. And I actually was in graduate school for social work at the time, and this just shows how strong denial can be, that I didn't categorize my experience as sexual abuse, even though I knew all about sexual abuse, understood it as a practitioner and understood what it meant to other people. I wasn't able to apply that to myself. So she was wonderful. She really helped me work through a lot of it. My husband was incredibly supportive, thank goodness, because that was really integral in my healing. But pretty early on, I did reveal it to my family. And my story is that I 100% was convinced, it never occurred to me that there was any other option, that my family would say, oh no, this is awful, we're so sorry, let's all look at what happened and heal together. And you could call me naive. I don't really see myself that way, because I think that's how it should have happened. But unfortunately, life is more complicated than that, and people, you know, don't always have those abilities. So my experience was actually quite different. Even though my brother pretty quickly admitted that it was true, and my family never doubted me, and at first said the right things, which is a lot of things that many survivors dream of having happen, I can tell you that these things alone, you know, aren't really what they seem, because actions speak louder than words. And what happened over time was I began to discover that my family did not want to address it. They did not want to talk about it. They did not want to look at it. They did not want to hold my brother responsible. Now, he was also a child, and I understood that. I understood that the fact that he'd done this meant that something terrible probably happened to him, and that he was a child in need and a child in trouble at the time. So that's why I thought, you know, we should heal together. I was angry at him for things that happened in our adulthood and for what he had done, but I was open to working together and healing together. And in fact, that's not at all how it went. He was very, very angry at me for trying to tell him how his actions had hurt me. And he was aggressive and rejecting. So, you know, I was hurt by that, obviously, and expected my mother and my family to support me, or at least understand where I was coming from. And so over time, what happened was a story that I have learned is, I don't want to use the word universal for people whose families don't understand it, but it's, I've really discovered this pattern, these symptoms, these manifestations of the second wound, of this re-victimization that happen over and over. It's sort of the same story in so many survivors' lives, and there are certain components to it. Even, you know, whether families believe you or not, they will often minimize it to the point where they just want to brush the abuse under the rug. And as you pointed out in your intro, it's really insidious and dangerous to, you know, keep a silence about sexual abuse. That's how it fosters. That's how it continues into the next generation.
Yes. For those that are tuning in, this is The Cure, and you're listening to Amy Cabell. We're speaking to Miranda. We're speaking to Miranda Pacciana, the creator of the second wound. And we're talking about abuse, what are the manifestations of abuse. And Miranda, you touched something very interesting, that they don't want to believe it. And it's almost as if people don't want to believe the truth when it's ugly. Exactly. And your situation was unique because this is a mother that wants to love both her children, but then she has to discipline one, take the side of the other, and that's very difficult for us mothers. But even in today's world, the re-victimization, the blaming victim, it occurs, and it occurs more than you know. Even in my daughter's school, a student of hers was being inappropriate on FaceTime with my daughter. My daughter eventually hung up the phone. She didn't do anything. She went to the school, told the school, told the principal. You know, this kid wanted her to take off her clothes or something like that. Just inappropriate for fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
So, you know, she was feeling very bad and very guilty. So she goes to her teacher for help. And when I come to the school, my daughter's in tears, crying super hard. She's been suspended from school. They say she's just as guilty as him.
I
could not believe it. Do you imagine after being re-victimized myself and being blamed myself, as much as I want to safeguard my child, this happens in today's world?
And you know, unfortunately, I can believe it, but it is shocking and backwards, and it's classic victim blaming in a situation that to me is pretty cut and dried, especially with a child of her age.
Yes, and, you know, she goes to them for help, but she said to me, Mom, I shouldn't have said anything. Mom, I was bad. Why did I say something? I mean, is this how we want children to feel? Aren't we, as adults, shouldn't we be responsible enough to at least give the child the benefit of the crap, the benefit of the, you know, of the point, you know, just, you know, just try to believe them. Children normally don't lie about these things. This is not a thing.
No, and she took a risk to tell the truth. And that was an upsetting lesson that she learned from her school.
Yeah, and, you know, and what I think the way that we can, and also parents need to know how to recognize sexual misconduct when it comes to their children, because sometimes children will not talk.
And now we continue with Amy Cabo and The Cure on 880 The Biz.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Amy Cabo, and this is The Cure. Today, we're talking about how to deal with the effects of abuse, and we have our special guest, Miranda Bacciana, who is an incredible abuse survivor. We were earlier talking about how sometimes it's difficult for kids to talk about abuse or to come forward, because one of the things that really hurt is that our caretaker or our family may not believe us. Sometimes people go into denial because they can't handle that somebody very close to them could do such an awful thing, whether it be their husband or their son. And us as mothers, we cannot understand it because we try to be a good mother. We do completely the opposite. We want to protect our child. And it's something that's difficult for us to understand. But see, God does a very nice thing. He puts in your path, if your family's not there, he puts in your path somebody that will be. For Miranda, it was a psychologist, a social worker, and her wonderful husband. For me, it was maybe some medication over time, my husband, music, and a lot of other things. But Miranda has great insight to tell us about how we can heal from not being believed, especially from those who are supposed to care about us the most. Okay, Miranda. So I'm sorry to have gone into break, but you were saying something that seemed kind of interesting. We were talking about, that you were telling us how your mother didn't believe you, and how sometimes it's difficult for kids to speak. And kids know this. Kids know that they might not be believed, that they might be blamed, that they might be re-victimized. I mean, they really know it. So if we're good parents, unlike our parents, if we want to do the right thing, how can we recognize the warning signs of sexual misconduct? In other words, what if you expect your children are victims of abuse?
Well, let me just say a couple things. That it's not that my mother didn't believe me. It's my family did believe me. But, I was explaining that although people think that that would be the answer, it's often the case, as in mine, that my family minimized it and wanted to brush it under the rug and not address it. And one of my concerns all along was that, you need to be cognizant of the next generation and protect them. And so if there's someone who has a history of perpetrating, we have to be very careful about having minors present with that person and, looking into whether they're okay or not to if they've really gotten help. And even if they've gotten help, I personally wouldn't leave a child with someone, in the care of someone who had this kind of history.
Well, it's important to break the cycle because, right. It really is a cold hard fact that the abuse is often, most often, by the way, perpetrated by someone you know or trust.
That's
a
right.
family
That's
member,
right.
a friend, your right. child's best friend, the teacher, the neighbor, a coach, or even a sibling. A lot of times they're award-winning coaches, and they're very likable yep. people. And it's the yep. person that, because people have this idea of what an abuser should be, so this person then is so nice and so wonderful.
Oh, and they can be very charming yeah. and yes.
And they would and never they, believe it in a million years. And you know what? They don't want to believe it. People believe what
right.
they want to believe, unfortunately.
To some extent,
Not
that is,
so
a,
much
that is a reason. Yes, and also, and like you're saying, perpetrators, especially, true pedophiles, will groom not just the child, but the family. And sometimes with public figures, they'll groom the public, as in the recent documentary about Michael Jackson. When you win over the public, when you have that kind of platform, it's very easy to then get people to trust you and want to be around you and be in the glow of your fame.
It's funny that you should mention the Michael Jackson, the documentary, because I had found an article that's very interesting. It says that first they rape the child's mind in order to rape their body. And the perpetrator's first step is to isolate the child. They become the child's confidant, very much like the Michael Jackson movie. You know, they start, you know, they get into their social life. They start texting them, Facebook. They, you know, they try to, they're things that they do. I mean, they want to look, to spend a lot of time with the kids. I noticed that my mother would surround herself with men that love to be with those kids and only the kids. And it's, there's something going on. If usually an adult pays attention to the kid and then quickly turns over to conversation with an adult. But that adult that ignores the adults and continues talking with the kid and seems too interested in the kid, that's a red flag.
Absolutely. I also wanted to touch on your story about your daughter that one of the main reasons that that is concerning is because, you know, children, one of the best way to keep our children safe is to educate them about the what is appropriate and what is not, and that they have a right to not only say no, but that and the important thing is to go and report if someone is making them feel uncomfortable in any of these ways, you know, and be really clear with no shame about what is appropriate and what's not, and what and that your body is your right, and you have a right to say I'm not comfortable with any physical, you know, with certain physical interactions, etc.
And they need to know what's inappropriate grooming, like jokes of sexual nature, flattery, sexual innuendo, provocative discussions of personal life, and, you know, inquisitive conversations about the student's life. You know, if it's a teacher, frequent hall passes, singling out the
student. These are all
and,
important.
You know,
things
even
that could be
even using pet
about.
Names. I didn't know that. Even using pet names,
mm-hmm.
And I thought it was okay to be the teacher's pet. But
I'm sorry. What did you say?
I thought it was okay to be the teacher's pet. But these are some of the things that you should consider. Not so much that it's a given, but just to look into it. Because there usually is other signs and symptoms.
Your daughter did the right thing, and I'm really proud and impressed with her that she used her voice to speak up. And you know, the fact that the school system, who has such authority and such you know, importance to a child, would respond that way reinforces the wrong message, which is that she should be ashamed, she should feel ashamed, and that she doesn't have a right to speak up to protect herself. And that's really the exact wrong message of what we want to give to children to keep them safe throughout life.
Well, and also that I'm Catholic. This is a spiritual school, so I expected them to do the right thing, and I was quite surprised. I really was.
Well, yeah. I mean, that is something that's systemic in a lot of institutions, and obviously the Catholic Church has its, you know, major issues with that are being revealed. I know in my state, I'm in Connecticut, the parochial schools, at least I know some in particular, I'm not sure what the state laws are, but they, I believe even the parochial schools are mandated to teach the educators and to some extent the kids about these dangers, and they're also mandated reporters have to report anything suspicious they see within hours or they can actually be criminally liable.
Well, and how about the desensitization? You know, that they had a talent show at my daughter's school where my daughter, she sings, and so we attended it. And one of the shows of the talent show is maybe an eighth grade boy, African-American, okay, he's black, and two little blonde boys about the same height of the Michael Jackson victims. And they were singing a Michael Jackson song. And I thought, wow, you know, what if people dressed up like Hitler or people dressed up like Ku Klux Klan? Wouldn't that hurt people's feelings? Shouldn't they be aware of that?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, that Michael Jackson, while he hasn't been convicted, there's so much out there that we can look at and, you know, at least be very alarmed by his behavior and not continue to hold him up as an idol to kids. That would concern me too. And unfortunately, I think that's really widespread kind of attitudes, because again, like you're saying, just like family members don't want to believe it or don't want to look at it, you know, that's a common response. in part because as a culture, we aren't comfortable with addressing sexual abuse. It's a difficult topic. It's a painful topic. A lot of people have been touched by it and haven't been able to heal from it yet, and maybe they shy away from it for that reason. There's all kinds of reasons, but we need to overcome them. It's crucial, and it really is a silent epidemic.
And the beautiful thing is that's why we're here, that we can be here for each other. Thank God there's a good God that loves us and has given us a good heart, that we can share our stories, our testimonials, and be there for each other. So, for those that are tuning in, this is The Cure, and I'm your host, Amy Cabo. We speak about abuse, how to overcome it, ways of healing. If you're suffering, if you've suffered, we can try to help you.
If you suffer from persistent depression, call Neurosciences Medical Clinic to schedule a free consultation for new effective FDA-approved treatments such as intranasal ketamine or NeuroStar TMS, a no-medication treatment. Neurosciences Medical Clinic. Call now, 786-600-7005. Neurosciences Medical Clinic, 786-600-7005, 786-600-7005.
And now we continue with Amy Cabo and The Cure on 880 The Biz.
Thank you for joining us. This is Amy Cabo, and I am The Cure. And I just played that song, Don't Give Up. And that, you know, when I hear that song, One Life for the Two of Us, I think of God. Because my parents did not believe me, and my entire family kind of abandoned me because they were afraid to know me, and people turned their back on me, and people betrayed me. It was just me and God, and it was one life for the two of us. But when people don't believe us, it's important to break the cycle. And there's a misconception that because your family's abusers or your parent, then you're likely to abuse your children, and it goes down through generations. And that's not true. You can do exactly the opposite. And Miranda Pacciana is a perfect example of that. I mean, Miranda, really, she is the online creator of Second Wound. And it's a very interesting point of view because it happens more often than we know. People don't want to believe us. Miranda, tell me how you didn't give up. What did you do to get through? And what was that point in time that said, okay, this is it. This is my last hurrah. I'm going to make it right this time. I'm going to make the rest of my life better.
Well, I think I actually have a very strong survival instinct, and it got me through my childhood, and it brought me at a pretty young age to address this. And I was really motivated to be healthier emotionally and to be able to enjoy my life more and not be saddled with so much anxiety and sadness that came from the shame that I had carried. And I really was able to do that work. It was hard work with my therapist. I can tell you that I really dove into it, and I was very, I would say I was depressed. I had serious social anxiety for a good year as I really became in touch with the pain that I'd carried so long. And at the end of that year, with the help of my husband, my therapist, my closest friends, I really emerged from it a different person, with a newfound confidence, and that grew, you know, that wasn't the end. It was sort of the beginning still, but it has grown over the years. And, you know, in some ways, being in therapy for a long time, which I have been, on and off over the years, it helps you handle life you really examine things carefully and examine yourself along the way. And in some ways it can help you evolve faster even, you know. I can talk a little bit about what was most useful for me in my healing and what I recommend to other survivors who are dealing with this re-victimization.
Sure, that would be great. Family.
Yeah. So in addition to therapy, group therapy or support groups are really valuable in a way that therapy alone is not quite able to give you, which is the feedback from your peers that that you're okay, that you're acceptable, that you're even lovable, and that it doesn't change who you are that you experienced this. And I can tell you that when I was in a support group, it wasn't about sexual abuse. It was just a support group for women that my therapist ran. And I actually used to think, and I used to verbalize this when I told my closest friends about what had happened to me when I first began to speak, I actually thought they were going to see me as tainted. And I would say things like, if you really want to tell your husband about it, I trust him so you can tell him, but only if he won't think I'm gross. Wow. And they would just say, I don't know why you would ever think that, Miranda, you know?
Want to let our listeners know out there that if there's anyone else that has experienced a family member not believing them or people mm-hmm. not believing them, and if you'd like to share with us or ask us a question, we're here for you. The number is 844-727-9922. Again, it's 844-727-9922. Go ahead, Miranda.
Okay, and the other major piece I wanted to touch on is that connecting with others and our relationships with other people, you know, and I have talked about that, but I just want to drive it home, whether it's our partner, our child, our friends, our therapists, that connecting with other people is the way that we heal. And it's especially difficult because our relationships and interactions with other people are what hurt us, you know,
yes.
Not just with sexual abuse, but in life.
It can be a double-edged sword. Yes, I understand.
Yeah, and we need to be careful. I mean, I think that oftentimes when we grow up with abuse, you're right. It doesn't mean that you are going to abuse. In fact, it's a very small chance. And if that were true, we'd have far more female abusers than male abusers based on the statistics, right?
Yes, it's just Hollywood describes it different. They always say when somebody's abused, oh, the perpetrator was abused themselves. And they keep pushing
and
that.
And often that's true, but it's a more complicated story, right? And it doesn't mean that you're going to go into abuse at all. And in fact, many people who have abusive childhoods develop a kind of empathy that is very powerful because they know what it means to be in pain. Often also, you need to develop a certain kind of what becomes empathy. You need to be able to read people's moods and energies in order to keep yourself safe in a family that's not safe too, right? So we develop these skills and we can use them for good or we can use them for bad. Some people do use them to manipulate and abuse. But to be able to heal slowly but surely through interactions with other people and learn what kind of relationships are healthy, what boundaries are healthy, and slowly form connections that are safer and valuable. And, you know, nothing is perfectly safe. Loving people means we hurt each other inadvertently. That's part of life, and we can grow and heal from that and do better.
Sure.
But it's so important.
Yes, I completely understand. It's very, very important because there's nothing more beautiful than human interaction. And, you know, it's wonderful that you had a therapist and that you were able to go to a support group and stuff like that, because there's nothing wrong with admitting we need help. For me,
that's exactly what I was going to say. And especially for male victims, I think it can be really hard to...
Yeah.
To admit that you need help, it doesn't mean you're weak. If anything, it takes a lot of strength and courage to acknowledge it and get help.
Yes. For example, when I went to the psychiatrist, I was very ashamed of what had happened to me. And I did not want to talk to her. So I would just go there, be really quiet. Okay, give me my medication and hear her speak. So that wasn't what did it for me. I had a very supportive husband. I didn't, group therapy isn't for everybody, but I find being part of a group in Facebook, I find that helpful because I read things that I thought nobody else knew about or nobody else would think of, but hey, look, somebody else is going through this and somebody else is mentioning
it.
And it's not only me and I'm not alone. And people do understand and people do care, but they can't see me. So that's how I can do it.
I think that's very valuable. It's one of the wonderful things about social media. I mean, obviously there's a lot of downsides to social media, but Yeah, and I'm sorry, I have a call coming through my phone. But I do have a Facebook page, Instagram, and Twitter, and a website where I post every day articles and messages about this exact topic. I can tell you that when I was discovering my family's reaction, I mean, it took me a while to come to terms and understand what my family's reaction really was, because they weren't blatant about it. They didn't say, we don't believe you, we don't support you. They said, we do believe you and support you, and then they went on to not believe or support me, to ostracize me from the family and victim blame me.
Yeah, my mother kicked out my stepfather when I was 7 years old, and it was very evident that he was sexually abusing me, and he came back 2 days later, never to be spoken of again. I was a black sheep of the family, and I started getting abuse some more, you know, physically, emotionally.
Oh, that's awful. That's awful. And I'm so sorry. It's not how it should be. Mothers should protect us. And unfortunately, your story, I hear again and again and again.
You know, I posted not too long ago, thank God for the hard times, because that's when I need to have faith the most. Mm-hmm, and the more practice I get, the stronger my faith becomes. So, yeah, life's problems don't really bother me. Yes, I'm sad about my daughter. I don't know of her. I don't know if she's brain injured. I don't think she can make it on her own. I want it to be there for her. I want it to lead her the right way. But, you know, my dysfunctional family wasn't happy about my memoir. And, well, you can't get rid of your dysfunctional family sometimes. They're just there. You can try to run away, but somehow they're your family. It's your extended family, and it is what it is. Doesn't mean you have to condone it, but you have to be aware of it, and sometimes you have to deal with it, and sometimes you have to deal with it in a painful way, like you and me have.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. You know, I trust God, and I leave it in his hands, just like I left it in his hands the day that I thought she would die when she was in a 24-day coma.
Wow. And, you know, and I've heard also from many of the survivors that I interact with that faith can be extremely helpful and extremely comforting. And, you know, in a way that can fill, not replace what your family could have given you, but fill a hole there, you know.
That, you see, I didn't need validation from a therapist or from a support group. I felt like I needed validation from God. And in order to have validation from God, in order to feel like God loved me or God forgave me, I had to change my ways. I had to become the person I should be or I wanted to be. And I started doing positive things that I neglected when I was depressed. I didn't groom my dogs. I wasn't cleaning the house. I wasn't taking care of myself. I do the minimum. I take care of my kid. This was throughout the custody battles. I was a single mother, no family. And it was very difficult, but I always knew that I can turn to God. And that's what helped me. That's what helped me through it all.
That's wonderful. And I'm guessing that you probably have a church community as well.
Well, I don't really go to church much.
Okay.
I'd hate to admit it, but I feel like having my kids in Catholic school is good enough, and I'm guilty of one of those parents. But I'm going to try. I'll try. I got to a point that I've had like 5 different run-ins with Catholics. And I want it to be non-denominational, but I can't deny it. I am Catholic. I pray rosaries. But
well, you don't have to deny it to me. I mean, but, you know, that's a personal choice.
But I do find comfort in my kids that are so cute, my dogs that you know, that are so loving, music. I have these happy moments. I said, God, how is this even possible that I can be so happy over a song, over little things? How can I enjoy life? You know what? If I didn't see justice, this is justice. The fact that I can feel happiness, the fact that I can be kind, the fact that I can be hopeful, the fact that I can feel peace, and nothing's going to bring me down, and nothing's going to break me. No, thank you, devil. Next.
Good. Well, I just have one last point that I would like to leave listeners with, and that's that one of the hardest things about recovering from the second wound or dealing with it, because I don't know if you can ever recover from it because it tends to linger on. But as your family continues to respond that way. But it can be very confusing to know that the messages you get from your family aren't correct when they're telling you that it's you, that you're the problem, and that if you would just be quiet and stop harping on this and, quote-unquote, move on, that everything would be okay. And I have a line that I use, which is, you are not the troublemaker, you are the truth teller. And really, it's an unhealthy system. Any system, any family that supports abusers and denies and covers up abuse and shames victims is an unhealthy system. And so if you're the one that is the black sheep and you're the one that cannot work in that system, it doesn't mean you're wrong. It probably means that you're healthy.
And I'm grateful that I'm not them. But guys, but thank you so much, Miranda. Thank you so much for being
with us.
And thank you for sharing your story. And of course, I'm going to put all the links to your websites or your information or your book, as well as any other guest, on my website, GodIsSecure.com. So if anybody wants to know more about this or speak to any of our guests, including Miranda, then they're welcome to. This is The Cure. I'm your host, Amy Cabo, and until next Friday, we will speak again.
If you suffer from persistent depression, call Neurosciences Medical Clinic to schedule a free consultation for new effective FDA-approved treatments such as intranasal ketamine or NeuroStar TMS, a no-medication treatment. Neurosciences Medical Clinic. Call now, 786-600-7005. Neurosciences Medical Clinic, 786-600-7005. 786-600-7005.
The Cure with Amy Cabo was brought to you by IMIC Research, 786-310-7477 or www.godisthecure.com. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. for The Cure with Amy Cabo right here on 880 The Biz.